This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
A small clearing in the forest was Carol's favorite place. She could lie on her back beneath the black canvas of sky. When her mother was alive, they would spread a yellow cloth and sit and eat apples. Carol cannot remember anything her mother said, only the sound of her voice, and that she sometimes took off her shoes and unfastened her hair so that it tumbled like ribbon upon her shoulders and neck. This is G.P. Gottlieb, host for New Books in Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today I'm talking to Simon Van Boy, whose latest novel, Night Came with Many Stars, is a stunning tribute to hope in humanity. No matter how many atrocious things his characters do, others are ready to perform acts of unselfish kindness. Carol's father gambles her away to a man who rapes her. An old Cherokee man at the poker game appears in his old pickup just as Carol's about to collapse on the side of the road. The stories weave back and forth in time so that readers slowly understand the family connections, and the writing is gripping and poetic. Hi, Simon. Thanks for joining me today.
Oh, you're very welcome. How are you?
Good. So how did you decide to name this novel based on William Steig's children's book? Our kids love that book, so did we.
I think because... The idea of, well, it's taken from the middle of the book when a donkey called Sylvester goes missing. And that's probably the worst thing that could happen to his parents and probably Sylvester himself. And so I like that despite what happens to Sylvester, the universe is still doing everything that one would expect it to. And so I quite like the indifference of things to our lives, you know, the indifference of the natural world.
I read somewhere that you're always working on two or three books at a time. How do you do that?
Well, I don't know why I do it, because I don't particularly enjoy it. I think that I just started and then the books have to be, they keep going and the editing is endless. And I don't really know why I do it. I suppose because I finish a book and then an editor has it for 3 or 4 months, during which time I start a new book, but then the editor comes back with edit, but then I don't want to give up the book I'm currently working on. And if this happens a few times, before I know it, I'm juggling several books, which is not pleasant.
But it makes sense. I understand that you finished writing Night Came with Many Stars a few years ago in 2018. How do you remember your intentions and thoughts about writing 3 years later?
I don't really have any intentions, which is probably why my books don't sell as widely as some of my colleagues' works. I write quite unconsciously. It's almost like it's almost like dreaming. I don't really, when I go to bed, I mean, there's certain things I'd like to dream about, but what I dream about is not really within my control. And I know that some people write and feel like everything is within their control, but I'm the opposite, really. The only control I have is in the editing. So whatever my imagination gives me, that's what I work with. And then my skills, what few skills I have as an editor, I employ to make as powerful as possible the gift of my imagination.
Mm. So this Night Came with Many Stars is set in the South. You were raised in Wales and the countryside
yes.
around Oxford in the country.
Yeah.
And then you ended up with a rugby scholarship to Kentucky. So could you talk about that,
American
how that
football.
Was?
Yeah,
so
American
it wasn't
football.
Rugby? It was American?
No.
Oh.
Yeah. And that was interesting. I mean, but you know, the shelf I had in my locker wasn't large enough for all my products. So, you know, I knew my football career wasn't really going to go anywhere.
But you stayed in college. You played all through college?
No, I dropped out of college. I found it a bit tedious, and I the few friends I had were not in college, and or they were about to drop out of college. I found the world more interesting than college, so I left, and then I went and studied at other colleges, just taking courses, really. And then I went back to university in England, but I was very unhappy, so I dropped out yet again of my third college. And then I went to an art school, and I was really happy there.
Okay. So then it's a writing degree?
No, I don't really know what it is. The art school, there weren't really any classes. They gave you a project and you had to do it. And then you just had to check in from time to time with your teacher, who may or may not be in the country. But it was a wonderful environment. I learned a lot from other artists. Much more than I learned from the teachers.
So interesting. And you set this particular novel in the South, and
yeah.
You really got the cadence and the language. And how'd you do that?
I suppose because I really love music, and speech is a type of music, or at least the way it reaches our ear. It could be compared to music in many ways, and so I suppose just mimicking how people speak, and I've always been able to do accents, and so I would just sort of, you know, become the characters myself, and or try to at least, and then I would speak the way they would, and I would employ only the vernacular and the rhythms, and I became quite obsessed with it, actually. But there's only so much you can do in the book, because then you start to think about, well, should I write it in a way where the person who's reading it is forced to pronounce it a certain way, but like Irvine Welsh in Trainspotting, which for anybody who doesn't speak Scottish, it's completely unreadable. But I thought I wouldn't do that because essentially, you know, a novel is a collection of compromises. And so I had to do something that I felt would be a better experience for the reader instead of trying to decode Kentuckian.
Mm-hmm. So I have a question. Why did you decide not to use quotation marks in the novel?
A couple of my favorite writers did it, and I thought it was quite nifty. I thought it looked quite good and quite modern. But then my daughter told me it was a very bad idea and I'd made the wrong decision. And on hindsight, I happen to think she's right. And so from this point on, I shall be going back to quotation marks.
Okay.
It was a mistake. Well, I shouldn't have done it.
It was a good experiment then.
Yeah, and that's all really art is. It's just one experiment after the next. But you always learn something with each experiment. And if you can somehow convince people to pay you to do it, then it's fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. So why does Old Man Walker, whose kindness saves your protagonist, why does he warrant only two sentences of description?
I don't know. I mean, I really don't know. That's just all I wrote, I suppose. I mean, if Joshua, my editor, had said, I think it needs a few more, then I would have tried it and see if it worked. But it's just such an unconscious process. I think I'm the only person writing at the moment who isn't consciously trying to, like, include things that are fashionable or trending, or I just really don't care about that. I'd rather work at McDonald's, and I actually I don't like fast food. So not that it, you know, and no disrespect to people who work at McDonald's, but I don't particularly like fast food. And also people think it's a Scottish restaurant. When they get there, they find out it's not. I think they're disappointed, but I'd rather work at McDonald's.
Simon.
Yeah.
Who thinks it's a Scottish restaurant?
McDonald's. Well, just the name, right? McDonald's.
Oh, nope. Never thought of it that way.
Oh.
So
like Campbell's soup,
okay,
Scottish soup,
right? That's also
no, right. I don't think it is, but people might think it is based on the name.
Maybe people in Great Britain think so, but in America, I think we're kind of used to it, just like, oh, another American name.
Yeah, okay. Probably anyway, because of Andy Warhol.
Probably,
yeah.
Despite her upbringing, Carol showers her son with love. Can you say more about Rusty?
Yeah, Rusty, I just sent him something for Christmas, actually, the real Rusty. I mean, all the characters are based on real people.
Oh.
They're all living right now. Well, they were this morning, but Alfreda, it's their real names too, but it's a different surname. But Alfreda told me, she said, Rusty sits on the porch all day hoping the mailman will bring him a Christmas present. So,
oh.
But Rusty really is I don't know if he has autism. He hasn't been diagnosed, but I mean, he fits all the criteria for autism, for a type of autism, in that he can remember the weather on any day since he, you know, was about 5 years old. And he can remember, and he can untangle pieces of string very, very quickly. And he can count spokes on a bicycle wheel very quickly.
Did the real Rusty also have trouble with his legs and trouble walking?
Yes, he did. And in the basement of their house in Kentucky, in Litchfield, Kentucky, he has his original leg shoe things, the things he had to put on, the prosthesis.
Okay, wait a second. So all of these people are real people, but the situations are also based on truth?
Most
or did
of
you
them,
invent?
Yeah, most of them. But I had to call it a memoir because you know how people are today. You know, that I just couldn't risk people saying, well, you know, they wouldn't have done that, or they didn't live there in that particular. So I thought I'll just call it a novel and hope people assume that a lot of it really happened. But also how things happened is also a kind of fiction, because remembering itself is a creative act. So in order to not get in hot water with what young people call haters, I decided to call it a novel and not a sort of memoir of this particular family. But the Bessie is based on my grandmother, actually. So she wasn't from Kentucky. She was from somewhere very far away from Kentucky, but not unlike Kentucky in how people have to stick together because they're very, very poor and in some ways disenfranchised. And then Carol's father was a sort of a conglomerate, sort of a patchwork of all the unpleasant people I've met in my life. I've had the displeasure of meeting. And there's very, very few. There are very few truly unpleasant people, I think, in this world. Carol's father is certainly one of them.
Well, what about Eddie? He seems destined for a fall from the very beginning, and it feels almost personal.
Yeah.
So, who is he based on?
Well, I feel like Eddie could be based on many people, myself included. You know, when I was 17, 18, 19, if I'd taken one step to the left, you know, one step to the right, or, you know, if I'd done something reckless, you know, it doesn't take much to put somebody on the wrong path. And then, you know, their friends and their family help them get off it. But I feel like there's a real epidemic of bad parenting, I think, at the moment. You know, parents who sort of either checked out emotionally or checked out physically from raising their children. And so I don't think children, you know, they find their own family, whether it's a gang or, you know, or something else. But I feel like Eddie's mother obviously has completely let him down in a way that many people who may be listening to this also have been let down. And you just have to forgive them, I suppose, and not make the same mistakes. But yeah, Eddie, poor Eddie. I mean, everything's against him from the start. But he does have love and friendship from Sam.
Yeah. When Samuel drops out of college and starts drinking, it feels connected to Carol's father. And of course, you know, there's that genetic component to alcoholism. So what about Samuel? What can you say?
Samuel's been one of my best friends for a long time. And he said he had to stop reading the book in places because it was just so emotional for him. You know, the car accident when he rolls the car into the river and also, you know, being hit in the eye. You know, those are real things. So he had to, it really took him back, he said. So it was quite emotional. But I said, well, that's great. I mean, I'm sorry for you, but I'm really pleased because that means I got it right. But, you know, we've been friends a long time that we can talk to each other in that way.
But Simon, does that mean you're the Eddie in this relationship?
In some ways. I mean, when I was on the football team in Kentucky, I was friends with a lot of Cherokee people and so I did get a lot of stories, and I met people's families and things like that. But I suppose Eddie is any good person or someone who means well in the world, but somehow they get sucked into this kind of web of what Shakespeare would consider this web of sin. You know, by just being around a sin, which is contagious in the Shakespearean sense.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Bessie, who's based on your grandmother, what did your grandmother run a house for unwed mothers? Did she help? What did she do?
Well, actually, no, she didn't. But her attitude, just her whole personality is Bessie. I mean, like, you know, when Bessie says, well, you know, if they killed him, if they murdered him, I hope it was for Christian cause. You know, my grandmother was very like that. She always said, you know, when you go to school, remember that attack is the best defense. So there was no punishment for fighting, but there was a sort of disappointment if you lost a fight. So she was tough. I mean, she grew up in a very tough environment. She ran away from an abusive husband with my mother and her two sisters, you know, when my mother was about 8. So, you know, my grandmother was a real survivor, and to some extent my mother was too. You know, in an emergency or in a crisis, my mother's fantastic, but in peacetime, she doesn't know what to do with herself, you know.
So Harold and Marjorie, Carol doesn't know how much her life will change because of them. Well, who are they?
Harold and Marjorie are actually fictional. They're, I think, the only two people who really aren't based on anybody. Well, I can tell you who they're based on because it's just you and me, so no one's listening. Yeah, it's just our private conversation. But just kidding, you know. So they're based on actually a couple from an Australian soap opera in the 90s that I was addicted to. I mean, I love soap operas. And so much so that I'm always paranoid that a critic is going to say that my books are too soapy. And I would just like... You know, when you feel like you've left the gas on and you're like, oh my God, I've left the gas on, or I've left the door unlocked, and you have this sort of weird light feeling in your stomach and you don't know whether to go back or go on. If a critic said that about my books, that they were like soap operas, then I would have that feeling. But You know, I suppose, which is ironic because I like soap operas so much. You know, it only takes 60 minutes, 60 seconds of viewing before I get hooked into a soap opera. But anyway, I was hooked on Australian soap operas as a boy. And so this particular soap opera had a character called Harold and his wife Marjorie. And I really loved them. I almost wanted to go and live with them in their fictional suburb in Australia. But there are lots of poisonous spiders in Australia, so I'm not sure that it would have worked out in the end.
Possibly not. I noticed that you write almost affectionately about so many of your characters, and now I understand it a little more. But did you have a favorite in the book?
Good question. Good question. I like Heather.
Yeah.
I like Heather because she's achieved something that I haven't. She's achieved something that I find admirable and I would like to achieve, but I haven't been able to, and I'm not sure I ever will, but I really want to. So I think Heather.
What is it that she's achieved?
Oh, she believes in God. I would absolutely love to believe in God, but I can't, you know, it's like, I just can't. There's too many dead end streets. I find myself when I go down a sort of thought experiment, and I just haven't been able to make that leap of faith. And whenever I ask anybody, it's like talking to an academic. They just quote the Bible or the Torah. So I can't really get any real answers through logic. And I know some people try and prove the existence of God through mathematics, but I'm not very literate when it comes to mathematics. So arithmetic is fun, but not mathematics. So I really enjoy Heather because she's so faithful and she's so loving. She embodies the perfect Christian. And I really admire that. And I just, yeah, so I like Heather. Oh, she's fantastic.
Weren't there other characters who were also committed and religious and
there are. Bessie for one. Yeah, but Heather's religious in a way that's not dogmatic. She doesn't, I mean, religion, unfortunately, well, the modern religions are so exclusive. And in that way, they're sort of dangerous because if you're not in it, then you're out of it, which is problematic. So, so Heather, though, doesn't sort of embody that dogma. What I mean by that is she's in it, but she sees everybody else is in it, but they just don't realize they're in it. And I like that about her. She's magnanimous. And she'll probably have a long, healthy life because apparently people who have faith like that really do have, it's very good. There's a lot of health benefits. It's salubrious. Faith is salubrious. So
Good to know. So, Simon, what are you working on now that Night Came With Many Stars is out?
I just finished a book, a sort of comedy about terminal illness, which is called
comedy.
Yeah, because the thing is, I mean, when you think about everything, you know, it's hard. Thinking is very hard. I think it's very hard for me because you start thinking about something, and then other thoughts start barging in, you know, and trying to take over. So luckily, though, there's writing, so you can kind of write things down and try and think, keep a thought going. Because what, you know, a thought is like walking down a corridor, and then the deeper you go, then all these doors start opening because the thought wants to branch off into other areas. But then it's very hard to simultaneously consider to be in all those different rooms at the same time while being in the corridor. But hopefully, thankfully, there's writing. And so this book, The Presence of Absence, is really about, it's about somebody who has a terminal illness, or they realize that they're going to die in the ancient Greek way, where people apparently before Prometheus knew the time and date of their own death, and it caused them enormous suffering, and it does cause him suffering at the beginning. But then he realizes that actually the dead don't suffer; they get off easy. It's the living that suffer, and so he starts seeing an end of life therapist in order to find a way to help his wife also not die when he dies, because they're very, very close. So it's sort of a comedy, really, because when you realize you're going to die and that you're not really John or Helen or Mark or Simon, you really are just have been just, you're just, that's who you think you are, but you're not really them. That's just the sort of like person du jour. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not really Simon. I mean, you're talking to somebody called Simon, but, and Simon's the hook I carry myself on through the world, but I'm not really Simon. I don't really know what I am, to be honest. I'm just sort of a weird mass of energy and I can't quite explain it. But when you get to that point of thinking, everything isn't frightening anymore, or the things that are traditionally frightening are not frightening. They're sort of funny. So that's what that book's about. It sounds stupid. I know I make all my books sound stupid. It's not intentional.
I didn't say that.
No, it is. I can tell. I listened to myself.
I was thinking we're just going to have to wait to talk about that book where we can discuss whether life and death. We'll discuss life and death when we talk about your next book. Okay.
Yeah, thank you. But writing that, was very difficult because not technically. I mean, it was technically, but I enjoy that. It's, I enjoy the technical puzzles, but why it was difficult was because I'm a real hypochondriac. I mean, I read about, I keep a list of the best hospitals. When I travel, I put the address and phone number of the hospital where I'm going and an alternative hospital in case that hospital's on diversion. So, I have all lists of hospitals all over the place, hospital for me is like, it's like a hotel where I can feel safe. But so I'm such a hypochondriac that writing a book about terminal illness, I started to become obsessed with health. And then I was checking my blood pressure 5 times a day. And I thought, what if this is some kind of metaphor, and you don't want to be, you don't want to be on NPR for, for the wrong reason, because an author writing about terminal illness finds out that he's terminally ill. So I started going to all these specialists. I didn't tell them why, obviously they think I was, had a problem. But so anyway, but I'm fine. And I'm fine. Thanks.
Oh, yeah, that was good. No.
Well, as far as I know, I haven't, the pancreas is difficult to get to, but.
Hey, Simon, I look forward to talking to you next time. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, you're very welcome.
And thank you for joining me. Again, this is G.P. Gottlieb, author of the Whipped and Sipped Mystery Series and host for New Books in Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today, I've been talking with Simon Venboy, author of Night Came with Many Stars. Thanks for listening, and I hope you're always immersed in a juicy novel. Happy reading.